One of the organizations that being the one that I'm not in now is one for retired people. I've learned to know several of those people who retired from other jobs, and we have a group that meets the first Thursday of every month for lunch. And we just have a grand time with no officers, no programs, nothing but lunch and talk. And
hey, that's
a good
organization. Yeah. It doesn't have a formal title after anything.
The first Thursday.
The first Thursday.
Yeah.
And that's just for fun.
That's just for fun. We just meet for fun.
But all the time you haven't been.
Of course, I've been in the Great Family Organization. I've been a member of the Rotary Club in Mayfield since 1930, which is 42 years. I'm now the oldest member of the club. I'm the longest membership in the club, with the exception of one, Mr. Charlie Dent.
Charlie Dent, but he's the clock man.
Yeah, clock man. And
you held offices there.
Yes, I was president of the club in 1934. At school, we always had these outdoor privies, and there was no water toilets in Harford County in a school until 1917. And we had those abominable outdoor critters, you know, that were a nuisance. We built a school down at Magnolia, a college school down at Magnolia. And it was right back of the college church. And the privy of the church was between our school and the church, which was right in our front yard, of the school's front yard. So I had a meeting with the trustees of the colored church down there, and we agreed to move this privy over on the back of our lot so that it could be a common place for both the church and the school. And we arranged with their board of trustees that they should do the moving of it and so on. Well, a few days afterward, I had one of the trustees of the church come into my office. He had his face all scratched up and plasters on his face. This colored man, he was a railroad watchman at Magnolia. And I said, "What in the world has happened to you?" Well, he says, "We had a church meeting over the moving of the privy." And he said, "We all agreed that we would move it without any charge and so on." I told him that we would give him $15 to move it. And he says, "One of our board members, he decided that he'd make the $15, so he went without our knowledge of it, and he had it all moved." And then we had the church meeting, and we all got into a fight. and this is the way he scratched me up. I had another case of a privy. We sold the building at Edgewood, and we hadn't sold the building yet. We were advertising it for sale. And I took somebody down there to survey the property and so on before the thing was sold, and here the privy was gone. And somebody had stolen it. And we never did find it. Never did find it. They evidently had gone there and hauled the thing away
Good heavens.
Before we sold the property, those were two instances of.
So you had to get a new privy. Where did you get funds for this?
I don't know. I don't remember the details of where we got the funds. But that was the disposition of some of these properties, you know, of these old school properties. You know, that's one thing that in my lifetime as a school superintendent was a most interesting thing. I came in as superintendent in 1915. And there were about 80 one-teacher schools in Harford County. And it was just at the beginning of the time when consolidation was beginning to be talked about. We had a man who'd come down to our teachers meeting here in Bel Air at the time from one of the colleges in Pennsylvania. I think it was Shippensburg or Millersville, I'm not sure which. And he made a talk and he said that he hoped to see the time within the very next few years when the schools of Harford County, instead of being 80 or 90, would be 12 or 15. And the powers that be rather smiled and laughed at him that this would never come to pass. Well, it wasn't very many years before that began to permeate the minds of our people here that there should be a consolidated system. And about 1920 it began, and I was the goat in trying to put it into effect. And I went around all over this county and had little meetings with the people of the one teacher schools, you know, and so on, and many of them rebelled. What are we going to do? To close up our little school here? And said, yes, we have to do that, and we have to make some consolidations and try to get them to the new school. Well, how can we? Because the bus system had not yet come into being, and it was almost a fight to get the people to consolidate those schools. One of the first ones was the Highland School, which was consolidated in 1907.
Highland.
School at Street. And we had no transportation, no buses or anything of the sort. And somebody conceived the idea of putting on a two-horse dating wagon from one of these schools and hold the children in a wagon school. They call it I've forgotten what the name they call it, but at any rate, for a number of years, they transported their children by just a two-horse wagon. Mm-hmm. The one by schools. And then that went on for a number of years, from 1920 to 1935. It took us to get any sort of consolidation going. We had the consolidations of Churchville, 1934. We had consolidation of Bel Air, bringing in the adjoining ones in Bel Air about the same date, so on until when I gave up in 1945, there was only one of those one teacher schools left.
Which one was that?
That was the one at Jefferson, Carson County. So that was one of the big problems that I had in my school career.
I guess it wasn't just the resistance, but there were funds and all sorts of other things.
Oh yes, funds in connection with it, because in 1924 we went to the legislature and asked for a bond issue for $250,000. Well, some of the people of Harford County just went up in the air. They never had abundant indebtedness and so on. And we had no support from newspapers. We didn't have a single newspaper in Harford County that opposed it. We had the opposition of many of the leaders who had sent their children to private schools. I could name some of the oldsters, which I was.
Come on, name some of them.
Well, Mr. Thomas H. Robinson, who is the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, who is very much a public spirit. The editor of the newspaper, the Egypt, Mr. John D. Worthington the Elder, that was the third John D. back,
right.
He was opposed to it.
Why? What was
it? Well, because of the indebtedness of the putting the bonding bid on the county. And we went around over the county and we just had minutes figures to go to these meetings, but Miss Mary Risto was very strongly for it, and she spent this county with me and two or three others. And when it came to vote in 1924, we carried it about 3-1.
Mm.
And it was the first bond issue of Boston County. Speaking of this opposition, Mr. Thomas H. Robinson met me in the corridor of the courthouse one day, and he said, "Yes, you carried the bond issue, but you did it by having all the Negroes in the southern part of the county vote for it."
Well, I would imagine that.
Oh, my. It was a great time.
The integration of the schools hadn't become an issue.
It hadn't become an issue. You know, I can see way back there that there was certainly a feeling against spending very much money on Negro schools at the time, 1915. I remember at least four schools, colored schools, where they were holding school in the colored church and using as benches the pews of the colored church to hold school. Well, there was a Bagley and Upper Crossroads of two of them. Benson was the third one. And I proceeded immediately to have schools built at all those places for the colored children. And of course, in later years, before integration came in, Dr. Willis provided for two main colored schools and consolidated. One was Habermas and the other was Hickory, you see. Central school, they call it the Hickory, which is the one now that is integrated and used for white and colored children.
Did you have colored teachers for each other?
Oh yes, we had an entirely different system of white and colored teachers. Colored teachers for all colored schools and white teachers for all white schools when I first came in. And we would have, you didn't hear of integration at all, and there was no idea of having even meetings together. You had a meeting of your colored teachers and you had a meeting of your white teachers. We did finally get a supervisor of colored schools who was a colored man, named the name of Dennis Noble, and he was a fine supervisor of colored schools, and he did more to bring some order out of the chaos that was in colored schools than anybody else that I'd ever had to work with me. He worked with me for 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Those things.
Did you, well, of course, the academic requirements for teachers wasn't quite the same.
No. The academic requirement for teachers, of course, was very, very much different from the present time. I came into a school system which was only less than a half century old, you see, because our school system of the state was actually came into being in the Constitution of 1867. And I first went to school in 1886, and it was only 20 years old when I began to go to school. And that one room system existed at that time, all over the. And they had Well, I will say they had some good teachers in the public school system. Even in those early days, there were usually local people, and a great many men were teaching school. In that early day, they had they didn't have college education, many of them, but they were, for that day, they were well-educated people.
Did they have normal schools then?
Yes, they had normal school in Baltimore City, which was our state normal school, which was in Baltimore City, probably about the 90s, that normal school started, and then they only had a 2-year course in that school. We had in each county of the state an examination for teachers. The superintendent would make out all these lists of questions in algebra, geometry, arithmetic, history, and so on, and hold a 2-day examination. The examination was held here in the school in Bel Air, and then they weeded out the ones that couldn't pass this examination and gave certificates to those who could pass it. And then the situation was such that the local community selected its own teacher. The each one-room school had 3 trustees. Those 3 trustees could select their teacher from the list of teachers that were approved from this examination that the superintendent gave. So that it was an entirely different setup from your present day, with the administrative authorities having full authority to appoint teachers and approve. It was an entirely different system.
Was it a good one? Was there a little politics involved?
Well, there was to a certain extent. You found cases of where the local girl who knew the trustees could get into the school as the teacher, rather than consider the ability and the education. There was some of that went on, no doubt, in the world. You can imagine.
And these were mostly teachers for the elementary schools. You didn't.
These were mostly teachers from the elementary schools, because we had no high schools. Our actual high school system in Harford County did not begin until, say, 1900 or after. We had an academic system, a school, some academies. For instance, the Bel Air Academy down here, which was called the Harford County Academy, dates way back to 1814. In a building that still stands and is one of the oldest buildings standing in Bel Air.
Which one is that?
And do you know where the Odd Fellows Temple is?
Yeah.
Well, right across the street from the Odd Fellows Temple, that building, which is now used as a dwelling, was built in 1814 as the Harford County Academy, and was used as the Harford County Academy from 1814 to 1886. For 50 years, that building was, and they had the higher education. They educated the men who were going into the medical profession, the men who were going into the legal profession, and so on. And many of the lawyers. Of the early lawyers of this county from 1820 to 1900 were educated in that little Harford County Academy. Like Judge Preston, Judge Bateman, Judge Waters, and many of those older legal men were educated There's Harry Preston, who was mayor of Baltimore City, educated in that academy.
What was the curriculum?
Well, they had, of course, the higher studies, geometry, both plane and solid. They had courses in mathematics of various types, and they even taught Latin and Greek in that academy.
You said men. Were there any women in the higher education?
There weren't at that time in that particular school for many, many years. It was only men. And the women were, where they were educated in private schools in the county. They had several of those private schools where they paid their tuition to them. And some of them were there. I don't know just how many, but some of those for women.
So that it was pretty well limited to those who could afford it.
Pretty well limited to those who could afford it. You were exactly right. And there were the high school system of this county did not come in until after 1900. I would say just a little before 1900, we had the school at Haverty Grace, which was, the old school was built in 1896, which became a high school. And the school which was built here in Bel Air in 1886, which is now the building where the Board of Education is, was built in 1886, and they began to teach grades 8 and 9, in addition to the elementary school, you see. And they had them all in one building. The elementary school and the high school were all in one building. It was 8 rooms there. Many years.
When did you go on to beyond the 9 years?
Well, we're in about 1910, we went to the 10th grade and 11th grade. About 1910, I would say we put on the extra two grades. We had up to the 11th grade. And then the 12th grade school was not put on until 1945. So that's a later.
Yeah.
I never, up to 1945, I did not have a 12th grade system, it was 11th grade system. We graduated at 11th.
How much opposition was there as each of these additions were made?
There wasn't any opposition. People were clamoring for it. It was, by that time, they had begun to see the advantages of it and so on, and I don't think there was the least opposition to the addition of the grades being put on.
Did the local graduates have any kind of trouble because of the city program, for instance, being perhaps a little more sophisticated?
Well, probably did in a little bit in the entrance into the colleges and so on at the time. And that was another one of the reasons that your 12th grade was put on in keeping with the city schools and so on and the entrance to colleges.
Mm-hmm.
But the old academy system was quite a system. There was one of the academies at Darlington, there was one at Jarrettsville, there was one at Bel Air, Abbey Grace, and Aberdeen. There were five or six of those academies. And they received a small appropriation from the state. And they were controlled by not a board of public board of trustees, but each one had its own local trustees who were appointed by the government state. And they handled the funds. And even up until 1916, when the old academy system was abolished and the funds taken away, those local boards of trustees had some authority in the appointment of teachers of the combined high school and academy. Here in Bel Air, up until 1916, that was a year after I came in as superintendent, they had two boards of trustees. One was the board of trustees of the public school. The other was the board of trustees of the academy. The board of trustees of the public school could appoint all the elementary teachers. The academy board reserved the right, because of their money that came from the state, to appoint the principal of the school. And one of the things that they demanded was that the principal should be able to teach Greek. And they taught Greek in the academy school down in Bel Air up until 1916.
How many principals would you have today if you required to
have? That was an interesting situation. I found that situation here when I came, that there were some of those old fellows, you know, who were the old board of trustees, like Judge Harlan and Mr. S. A. Williams and Dr. Vandiver, a few more of them. They thought that they had to have the ministers, training of the ministers, that they had to have the background, had to have at least Greek and Latin.
They had the trustees had a lot of control over the curriculum too.
Oh yes, yes, had a lot of control over the curriculum in those early days. Of course, the beginning of administrative authority by the superintendents of the state and the State Board of Education came in 1916, when we had a law passed that gave the whole authority for the appointment of teachers, the curriculum, and everything was under the charge of administrative officers who were supposed to be the educated professionals. But up until that time, it was by other boards.
Well, you came in right at that time.
I came in right at that time, in 1916.
You had a chance
to. And that's the first year that we ever had any compulsory education law, in 1916, here. And then the first compulsory education law in the state required them to go to school up to the age of 13. And then from after 13, they must go 100 days, at least during the year. Then, of course, after a few years, 1923, I think it was, it was made totally compulsory that they had to go up until 18 years of age.
Why the 100 days the kids needed on the farm?
Well,
and that sort of thing?
That was another situation that in my boyhood days was very prevalent. The farm boys would not enter school until November, middle of November, and they stayed in school until about the 1st of March, and then they were out. So that even in the school that I attended from 1886 to 1897, at Old Dry Branch, there were boys who came in the middle of November and went out the 1st of March, so that only got that much schooling. Fortunately for me, my father believed in education, and we attended the whole year, myself and my brothers.
How did the kids themselves feel about it? Did you feel envious of them?
Well, I guess probably did feel a little bit envious. Well, I never did. I always felt that well, it was for my own good. At least my father told me so. A little bit of the story that first brings in some of my life. Of course, the political convention of 1912 is a right memorable one. Taft was running for president on the Republican ticket, and Mr. Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, didn't agree with him in their palaces, and Teddy Roosevelt came out with the second party, the foremost party, and they stumped this country against each other in 1912 for the Democratic, for the Republican nomination. And they, an unusual thing, they both came to Harford County.
Mm-hmm.
Roosevelt came to Havergrace and made a speech at Havergrace, and it was my good fortune to attend that meeting and hear it.
What happened?
Havergrace. And a few days after that, he made an address in the in Baltimore City, and I went down there to hear him. So I heard Roosevelt, in my, Teddy Roosevelt, twice in my lifetime. And I've never heard Taft, but I was the manager of the baseball team of the of Aberdeen in 1912, and we fortunately were going from Aberdeen up the Northeast to play a baseball game on Saturday afternoon, and the train pulled into Aberdeen, and we got on the train, and Mr. Taft got off the train, and I saw Mr. Taft at Aberdeen, and then they met him there with cars and brought him to Bel Air, and he made an address in Bel Air. I didn't hear that.
What were your impressions of him?
Well, I my impression was that he was a stormy individual who had the his knowledge of people and his knowledge of things very well ingrained in him, and that he was going to put forth what he believed to be right, no matter what other people thought. And while his voice was to me like a threshing machine, it was a peculiar delivery that he had, but he certainly was, in my opinion, a great man. I visited his grave in Long Island afterwards. Very interesting to me. I was always a great admirer of Teddy Roosevelt, even though I was a Democrat.
Well, you've known a lot of politicians, national and local,
yeah. And then fortunately, I'm talking about myself. But fortunately, in June of 1912, I attended the state teachers' convention at Braddock Heights. And on Friday afternoon, after the convention had adjourned, I came to Baltimore with my Uncle Charles T. Wright, who was the former superintendent of schools here, that was my superintendent at that time, and John Worthington. We met John Worthington, that's the John that died a few years ago, in Baltimore, and we met them outside the Armory in Baltimore, where the convention was being held that nominated Woodrow Wilson. And we had no idea that we could ever get into the convention. And some crooked doorkeepers and so on were taking up the tickets and selling them outside for a dollar and a half. So we put up our dollar and a half and marched into the convention as a 1912. And that was Friday afternoon, and we stayed in there until 10, 12 o'clock that night, listening to the speeches in the convention and so on. And during the convention, they got into many squabbles over the nomination. Woodrow Wilson and Chance Clark were the two main people who were asking for the nomination, and William Jennings Bryan, of course, was the fiery one there, and
He was there?
And William Jennings Bryan came into the convention, and I wasn't any further from him than behind that door, because I was standing down in front of the rostrum, and he went up on the podium to make his speech, and they refused to let him speak. And I can see that he stood there waiting for them to decide whether or not he should speak. And I heard that he made one of his famous speeches there for Woodrow Wilson. So that I saw Mr. Bryan as well as some of these others. And then I went back. The tickets had run out. The tickets had run out, and they announced on Friday afternoon that they would hold the convention on Saturday morning. I went back from Aberdeen on Saturday morning. I got into the convention, and I stayed all day on Saturday. It was carried over until Monday. I went back on Monday and stayed all day in the convention of 1912, all day on Monday, and until noon on Tuesday when Woodrow Wilson was nominated.
Oh.
And there were 40 some ballots. They called the roll 40 some times while I was. So I sat and listened to it.
You didn't participate, you just sat there and took it
all
in.
I took it all in. But it's really one of the highlights of my life to have been able to attend the Saturday convention in 1912.
Oh, yes, it was educational.
Educational, and to see those big men, all those men. I can see that speaker up there, great big man, Ollie Jennings from Kentucky. He was the chairman of the convention, and he before the days of microphones and so on, and they had to talk so loud to speak to the people of the army, and he hammered on that desk until he broke the desk.
That's a big place, was it filled?
Oh, it's filled. It was filled with hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, everything. And I saw the demonstration and the marching around, you know, of the delegations and the flags and banners and all that, you know, and the hot hollering and carrying on.
Well, it hasn't changed much then.
That's an interesting thing to me.
Oh, have you written about this at all?
I have only written it up as I have my daughters and nephew, niece, have asked me to write up some of the things of my lifetime which I have done, which are not for publication, and about 200 or 300 written pages of it may lie somewhere around here. I don't know where it is. Little events of my lifetime and the people that I've known.
Why wouldn't it be for publication?
Well, it's I did it for my family, really, and the family. There.
I understand when you write letters that you write them very entertainingly, you even illustrate them. When did you become an artist?
I'm a very poor artist.
What kind of illustrations are they?
Well, I don't know. I think it was born in that way. Well, it's just my family.
Oh, definitely your family.
Yeah.
Mr. Wright, around 1906, I believe you went to the Maryland Training School for Boys for a couple of years.
Yeah, that's right. A year and a half.
And in what capacity did you
go? I was a teacher and officer at the Maryland Training School for Boys. That institution was in West Baltimore. It was more like a jail or a penitentiary than anything else, with a big high wall, 20 feet high, all around it with a watch box on each corner where we would have an officer sitting in the watch box to keep boys from escaping from the institution. And I came there about June the 15th of came down there in Westminster just before I graduated and asked for a position there, and they assigned me to one immediately. I graduated on Monday morning and took on Tuesday morning, I had my job in Baltimore City.
What motivated you to go there?
Well, I knew of the head of the institution, Mr. James M. Hendricks, who was a friend of my Uncle Charlie's here, and I knew of him, and I went down there and talked to him. I did not know him at the time, but I knew of him, and that prompted me to go there because I knew that he was there as head of the institution. And he gave me the job immediately, and I was assigned to a division of boys from the ages of about 10 to 13. And there were in that division anywhere from 80 to 90 boys, and they were under my charge. I had them from 6 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. And it was my job in the morning to assign them to their various positions. They worked in shops around the institution, and to have charge of seeing that they were clothed with the uniform, took them to the tailor shop and so forth. I went to my job to look after them from the standpoint of medical attention by sending them to sick, taking them to a doctor. Then at 1 o'clock, I gave them over, with the exception of 40, to another attendant, and I taught school from 1 o'clock until 6 each day.
7 days a week?
Well, 6 days a week to school, but 7 days a week I had charge of. And
what did you teach?
Well, I had charge of boys of about the fourth and fifth grade level, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade level, probably. And attention to various things, that they were teaching in the public school.
Was this innovation that kids hadn't been taught before?
Well, they were all types of youngsters, from broken homes. Some of them were in there for misdemeanors, thefts, and that sort of thing, you know. They were that type of youngsters. And many of them were not very excellent students. In other words, they hadn't had the preliminary training. And of course, you just had to take them as they were and teach them as they were. But I had very happy days there. It was a hard grind. But I got an insight into boys that I never had would have gotten in any other way except being thrown with that type of boys for almost 2 years ago.
What makes it easy?
Well, fortunately, they needed a principal at the Aberdeen High School. And I got a telephone message one day to come to Aberdeen to meet the trustees up there that they would like to consider me for trusteeship. Got on the train and went to Aberdeen, met with Mr. Tevis Baker, and Mr. Nick Wolford Carr, and Mr. Orion Michael, who were trustees. And when I left, I was offered the job. A principal took his Aberdeen school at $1,000 a year.
Big deal.
Wasn't that a big deal? I was getting $50 a month, and my board at the other place.
Was that experience at the school traumatic in any way? Did it the type of children you had to work
with? Well, the type of children, you learned a great deal about the boy who was a wayward boy, a boy who hadn't had any home training, and things of that sort. You could see in them that there was a lack of home training, many of them from broken homes, and it was just an interesting experience to try to instill into them some of the principles of morality and honesty and uprightness.
You had some success on
it. And I felt that I got near some of them, and after I became even superintendent of schools, I would have some of those boys drop into my office here in Bel Air and tell me how what influence that I had on them. And that's 2 years that I was down there, almost 2 years that I was down there. I remember one who had gotten a position with the gas and electric company and had a very responsible position. He could come in and tell me how much he appreciated what I did for him.
Oh, you're rewarded, thank you.
But it was really interesting. I helped to pick out the first group of schools of boys who came out to this new institution at Loch Raven. The Loch Raven system was an entirely different system in that it was a cottage system. With about 30 or 40 boys assigned to each cottage at the new Loch Raven, they were abandoning the old jail system in West Baltimore and coming out there. And I helped to pick out the first group of boys to come out there. They wanted a group of boys that they were pretty sure wouldn't run away and things of that sort, you know. And my lot was up to pick those out of my group.
The concept in the on the type of school has certainly changed.
Oh my, the change is terrible.
How do you feel about the change?
Oh, I think that it's wonderful, and the changes that they've made. I don't think it's perfect by any means, and probably never will be, because of the type of issues that they have to deal with. But if they can get the proper people in a cottage system where they can be a father and mother to those boys for the time that they're there, that they can do a lot with them. And that did not exist in the old system. It was a jail system, the old system. You do this and that's it.
Well, even the schools were almost a jail system.
That's right, that's right. The whole concept has changed. And I think it's for the better. Of course, I think they're a little troubled. Well, they're overcrowded. That's the trouble. They're overcrowded. Institutions to such an extent that they can't do the job efficiently.
Did that guy answer? Because
more
money and more buildings?
More money and more buildings and more that sort of thing. And I think the movement now to weed out the incorrigibles, that to me is the bane of the jail system and of the reform school system, is the throwing the bad apples in with the good and expecting to do something with them. And they're improving that.
Well, how about in the school system? It's pretty much like that.
Pretty much like that. You have to have it in the public school system, mm-hmm. Of course.
Does the poor student benefit from the better student, or is the better student pulled down?
Better student pulled down.
Why? Good supposed to be triumphant.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm fearful that it's well, then I came to Aberdeen and was there 8 years. And one day I got a call from the Board of Education to try to get the facilitation closed. The Albert Barr, saying that the board is disappointed in citizen schools and other things for the effect. I didn't ask for the job. I was trying, but the board was taken.
Did it frighten you a little bit?
Frighten me a little bit. I said, give me time to go home and talk to my wife. She was there for the last evening, and I said, give me time to talk to her.
Was your wife in Baltimore with you at this training school?
No, I wasn't married then. I didn't marry until I was in Aberdeen. I've been in Aberdeen 5 years for 3 years before marriage.
Oh.
I went there to spend the money.
Was she one of your students?
She was one of
your teachers.
She was one of my teachers.
Oh, the magic kid over there. After being a teacher and principal, and then all those years as superintendent, you still haven't retired, though, have you?
No.
You're still active in...
I do two things. Not to them now. I was very much interested in various things. I was president of the State Teacher Association in 1935. Then I've been interested in the Outdoors Lodge. I've been a member of the Outdoors Lodge of Aberdeen for about 55 years. I'm a presiding officer in 1914. I've been in the Planet Lodge here for 54 years. I was just presiding officer in 1920 and 21. In addition to all my other things, I was interested in, I joined Presbyterian Church here in 1918, and I was superintendent of the Sunday School for 34 years in Presbyterian Church. I was an elder of it for more than 30 years.
That's what you put you down as Presbyterian.
Presbyterian. So that I've been interested in various, in these other various things. I was interested in the library from the time I came here to Dyer, but I never was on the board until about 1935, somewhere along there. I became a member of the old Bel Air Library Board with Mrs. Reed, Mrs. Roust, Dr. Willett, Dr. Van Bibber, myself. I think we were members of the old board when we used to meet. We met up in an upstairs room, Market was there next to Rich's drugstore. In the early days when I was first on the library board. And then when the state took over the library system in 1945, I was one of the original trustees. And served as its secretary treasurer for 13 years. I did all the work. I did all the bookkeeping work and so on for most of those years. Paid the library people and all that sort of thing.
All that pay. The library was then located on Main Street.
Well, after we moved from the little room up there above this building near Richmond's drugstore, We purchased a little stone building almost opposite the Army. It was a little stone building, and we had it renovated, and in the charge of Mr. E. P. H. Harrison, who was the man who did the renovating, and it was made into a fairly nice little library with Mr. Philip Hall as the librarian.
It had been a private dwelling before.
It had been no private dwelling.
And you bought the
property? We bought it. I don't remember what we paid for it, but our board gathered together the money and some public subscriptions and bought that building. And we owned that until 1900. I don't remember the date.
I think I have
the date. Yeah, the date probably. But then, of course, when the new library system came into effect, we bought the old church building, Metropolitan Church building, and sold the other. I happened to be the treasurer of the fund that was raised to purchase the church building, and I think I turned over to Miss Fine all the old records from that, and all the people who made the donations who collected that. I was thinking of the thanks to them. I think it's about $15,000 for that building.
Did you use the building just as it was? Did you renovate it?
Practically used the church building as it was. For very little things. We didn't have money to do very much.
Where did
you get
your book?
Of course, we received only 2 cents on the tax rate. How's that?
I just wondered where you got all your books. You didn't have much money.
Well, we had some donations, and of course, we appropriated some of it from this 2 cent tax rate. You see, the original law provided that each county could levy or must levy at least 2 cents on the tax rate for library purposes. And we collected that, of course, from the county commissioners, and very often they asked them for a little more if they could. And with that, we paid the help and purchased what books they could.
Harford County was one of the first to take advantage
Harford
of it.
Harford County probably was about the first. We had a meeting in the courthouse with Mr. Vaughn Flannery, who was the speaker at that meeting, as I remember, and he was the editor at the time. He very strongly advocated the county commissioners taking it over, and the county commissioners very soon after that decided that they would accept the proposition and to levy the 2 cents that was required on the tax rate. As treasurer of it was my duty to collect that money, and we had some very interesting things, which nobody knows but myself, I guess. Every year, they would give us a certain amount of money, and then the state superintendent of schools had charge of checking up to see that we got our state money, and that we couldn't get our state money unless the county commissioners had levied their 2 cents on the tax rate. And there was always a discrepancy about the amount of money that they paid us and the assessable basis. And sometimes I had to almost fight to get the additional money that up to the
but
time
you did
to
get
satisfy.
It?
Yeah, always got it.
How did you choose that job? Oh boy, that wasn't a fun one, was it? How did you choose your books, your type of reading?
Well, that was all done by our librarian and a committee of the board. I was never on the committee for the book, but I always had to start with the financial and secretarial part of it. That was enough for me.
How do you feel about the idea of anyone other than a professional librarian selecting this type of book? Do you think citizens have a right to request censorship and so forth?
Well, that's a question that I don't know whether I can answer. I don't know whether I know enough about that to answer. My own feeling in the matter is that when you select professional people to do a professional job,